This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your highway or my way of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You are listening to my favorite Usher song of all time. That's You Make Me Wanna. This is... Woo! Doesn't really get much better than this. This is early-ish Usher, young Usher, real talk Usher, pre-confessions Usher, but still confessing. Usher is about to perform at the Super Bowl this coming weekend, and I think Usher's curiously under-discussed, undervalued, under-conversed. And so this week, we're going to get into Usher's career. We're going to talk the early years. We're going to talk Usher's relationship to classic R&B, new jack swing, hip-hop, also later Usher, EDM, pop, trap, etc. We're going to talk about the various phases of his career. We're going to talk about the way that Usher's celebrity sometimes got in the way of how his music was received. And we're going to talk about Usher as a technician and a practitioner of the form, which also I think sometimes doesn't get as much lip service as it probably should. So to get into that this week, we've got two guests. We've got Danielle Amir Jackson and Thomas Hobbs. Danielle is the editor-in-chief of Oxford American and also recently profiled Usher for the Times Magazine. Danielle, hi, welcome to Popcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. Thomas Hobbs is a freelance music writer, writes for The Guardian, The Evening Standard, Stereo Gum, also recently profiled Usher for The Evening Standard. Thomas, welcome to Popcast.
Hey, very cool to be here.
I'm psyched to have y'all for a number of reasons. What I was really struck by in reading both of your profiles is I feel like you both got stuff from Usher that I haven't seen a lot of in Usher profiles over the years, and they both felt, even though we're kind of functioning in the same time frame, I felt like they were two really effective profiles of a person that felt very different, that landed in different places or took different pathways to tell a story about a person at the same career moment. Before we get into big picture, Usher career, how do we arrive at a stage like the Super Bowl, etc., I'd love to talk a little bit about the experience of the conversation, time spending, et cetera. Danielle, I know you were working on your piece like over some time. Do you want to talk us through a little bit of the reporting process and kind of Usher's engagement with it?
Sure. First of all, thank you for the kind words about the story. So I worked with Usher's publicity team over about almost a year, planning the story out, thinking about what the main marks are. And I set out to tell a story that was a little bit different in the beginning. I wanted to talk about Usher kind of in the lineage of a tradition of R&B folks. And just as a craftsperson, I think that over the years, we've read a lot and talked a lot about Usher as a celebrity, his persona, his like relationships, personal life. But, you know, at the core, he's really great at what he does as a vocalist, and he's listened to a lot of great folks before him and talks about that a lot. So I set out wanting to do that. The team was really generous in giving me time and access, and I spent more time really shadowing him, like following him around to a number of just engagements and errands, more than talking to him in a formal way. The greatest and most, like, I guess, insightful stuff that I got from him was in those kind of in-between moments, these liminal moments between spaces, going from one just highly choreographed, like, appearance to another. it starts out, and the first weekend I was with him was about a year ago. It was Grammy weekend, and though Usher was nominated and has been nominated a bunch of times, one thing I kind of found out in the reporting and talked about with both Usher and L.A. Reid is that Usher has never won a Grammy in a category that has been televised. So he's been nominated like 23 times and has won 8 Grammys at this point, I believe. The first one was 2002. But never has he been able to go on stage and accept an award. And this, you know, is
undervalued. Undervalued.
Exactly. Undervalued. Like his artistry in particular, but also, I guess, the genre that he's a standard bearer of. That's just one example. So Usher was not attending the Grammys, but he was attending a number of events that, like hosting a party at the Hollywood Palladium. And that's how the profile opens up. And attending a number of other parties over that weekend, and including one that like Latto was in. And so there were just a lot of choreographed kind of events. And there was also, you know, at the time, the team wasn't sure if when exactly they were going to be releasing the album. I think you'll see in the profile, I mentioned that it had been pushed back a number of times up until we found out that it was coming out around the Super Bowl. At this time, it was possibly going to be coming out that spring. It had essentially been ready to come out for a while. So, you know, I think the team was just waiting for the moment. So there are just a lot of appearances, and I got to follow him at all of them.
Can I ask about, you mentioned the liminal spaces, right? And you know, we sort of know from like years of doing celebrity profiles, like sometimes an artist is perhaps at their most open or vulnerable, almost when you're not expect, like when it's not as formal, right? But I wonder, conversationally, one of the things about Usher, part of, I think, Usher being undervalued in the big picture is, I think, a lot of music press in the 2000s and 2010s, like certainly post-Confessions era, I don't know if you're getting loads of huge Usher profiles in like the 2010s. I might be wrong. You might have found some in your back research. But I feel like after the Confessions era, he did kind of sort of move into the realm of like celebrity, quasi-tabloid figure, at least for that spell of time. And I felt like maybe the music press took a step back from covering him as thoroughly. I wonder what your sense of his conversational rhythm was when you actually were able to lock in with him. Was he reluctant? Was he open? Did you have to press? Like, how was the discursive rhythm?
Early on, before we really locked in, so just the first moments of meeting, like on the set of the video that I saw and then at the party, I felt like, you know, Usher is a polished professional who has been interviewed for, you know, almost as long as I've been alive, for, you know, more than 30 years. So I felt like, you know, the answers and his presentation early on were just wonderfully coached and trained and erudite. And, you know, he was gentlemanly and courteous, one of the first people to ask me if I was doing all right. But in those in between moments, like riding to venues, at one point Usher drove me from a meeting to a fitting at his house. He played me some songs, and there's a moment when like Marcus Houston drives by and we end up seeing him. And, you know, he spoke really candidly about his anxiety in releasing, or just the hesitance in releasing the album, the body of work, the next body of work, and at trying to figure out how to appease his different audience groups, you know? So I felt like that was the beginning of some real candid conversation. It's just that it took a while, and it really happened outside of the lights and outside of the formal, like, I'm interviewing you right now at this moment. So I'm glad to have caught all of that recording. I was always recording, and he was aware of that. But in those looser moments, that's when I really got some insight into just how he was feeling at this moment in his career, and just like a little bit of the reluctance and the anxiety, you know, and this like a real sense of his perfectionism and how that has been wonderful for him, but also possibly not as wonderful for him.
Thomas, I wonder, a sort of similar set of questions. I know there's a lot of subject matter about music history and also the relationship and almost the tension between a public self and a private self that you really get into in your story. And I wonder if you could talk to me about the nature of that conversation.
So I was really interested in, I think when people think of Usher, we think of this person with this kind of beaming $100 billion smile. I always kind of wanted to see what was kind of behind that smile. I always remember like on Follow Me when he, I think he's got a lyric on there where he says, sometimes I've got a smile when I don't feel like smiling, sit back and ride when I feel like driving. And to me, that lyric was a real kind of great indicator that, you know, behind the kind of kissing babies like politicians do kind of outward persona, that there was kind of something hidden behind that. So I thought it was really interesting to kind of dig deeper into kind of who that person was. You know, also for me, one thing that's really kind of fascinating about Usher is I think that he sings very kind of ancient universal truths about love. You know, concepts like lust, loyalty, infidelity, heartbreak. You know, just the same way Teddy Pendergrass used to always kind of place female desire at the forefront of the music. I felt like, you know, forcing you to almost empathize with the person he was serenading. I always felt like Usher did that. So at the start of the writing process, I just remember sitting down and I just had this line in my head, kind of like, he's the Aristotle of baby making music. And the more I kind of dug into this idea, the more I remembered, like, you know, those kind of college classes on kind of philosophy and quotes like, you know, love is for a single soul to inhabit two bodies, to love is to identify with another body. It just got me thinking, that's what Usher does. That's why we love Usher. Like, his music switches from the male and the female perspective. And I kind of really thought it was important to kind of narrow down in that, where that kind of storytelling comes from.
What's a particularly emblematic Aristotelian male-female perspective Usher song? Because we should listen to something to kind of get the point across. What's a song you think we should listen to that kind of captures that?
I think Can You Help Me is an incredible track. Like, that to me is probably my all-time favorite Usher song. Like, reminds me of when Teddy P singing on Miss You by the Blue Notes, kind of sounds like he's singing into a bottle of whiskey. There's a kind of hopelessness about it, but he's kind of, you know, calling out for the person whose heart is broken. He's singing about, you know, girl, I put your love up on a shelf and I guess I just left it to die. I think that's an incredible lyric because it kind of talks, it considers, you know, how he's kind of neglected his other half. I think there was definitely a period of R&B where, with people like R. Kelly in particular, where it was just all about running through as many kind of potential lovers as possible, conquests and notches on your belt, and not considering the kind of ramifications. And I think Usher for me was really kind of radical in making me step in the shoes of the person whose heart he'd kind of broken.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
One thing that I know from years of profiling is sometimes you walk into a situation with someone you've spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about in a very particular way. It's maybe especially through the lens of criticism, through a particular songwriting framework. And then you present it to that person and they say, either I don't know about that, I haven't thought about it that way, that's right, that's wrong. I wonder, did you bring that into the conversation? And I wonder, what was Usher's receptivity to that idea, if you were able to really go deep with it?
I did. So the story of how I kind of turned this around is very different to Danielle's, in that I was kind of asked, do you want to go to Paris next week and interview Usher just out of the blue and then turn it around within 3 days? Typical kind of freelance grifting type shit. I've also just become a dad. So I'm kind of like, you know, paying all the bills, like, I'm hustling. So I kind of just thought, right, I'm not going to sleep for 2-3 nights. I'm going to really research this. That's what I did. I listened to every song Usher ever put out, all his influences, all his genealogy, to the point where I'm on the kind of Eurostar going into Paris and other journalists are all talking, cracking open beers with the publicity people. And I've got my headphones on. I'm like, sorry, I can't do this. We get to it. We see him play. And Dave Chappelle was there randomly. And I just remember his arms looking big as shit. It reminded me of like Ultimate Warrior's arms in the 80s. But anyway, the other crew of other journalists who were there, the media people, they all go out for this after party with Usher and Dave Chappelle and all these people. And I went back to the hotel room and just listened to his catalog even more and make notes. So I think I bring that up because I think he really appreciated that I could draw that timeline, that genealogy, really kind of dig deep into kind of the deep cuts and kind of piece together the whole narrative. And I think what he appreciated in particular was, you know, just this idea that Usher's music is overtly political. Like, you know, maybe sometimes people don't look at it in that way, but, you know, this is a guy who grew up in Chattanooga, you know, 2 years after he was born, 4 black women were injured in a drive-by shooting by the KKK. I mean, that is an incredibly hostile environment to have grown up in. And I think, again, going back to what I said about that smile, the person that was behind that smile, almost a kind of perseverance, the kind of the real power behind that smile, those are the things that I kind of drew upon, I guess, in the questioning. And I think he, you know, I think he appreciated that. I think he could see the bags under my eyes and realize, like, shit, this dude was like really up all night listening.
I will say also, just as a brief sidebar, we are in a traumatized time for music writing, which I know many people are aware of. If you listen to podcasts, I'm sure you're aware of what's been happening in the music press in the last few weeks, and certainly over the last several years, broadly speaking. I do want to say, if you're interested in being in the game, that's how you do it. I just want to underscore like that, like, you don't have to go to the after party. You should study up. It pays off. That's all I want to say. It's a brief sidebar. We'll talk more about the ongoing crisis in music journalism in later episodes of Popcast, because I have some stuff cooking. But I just want everybody to be mindful that, like, that's what the game, as what they say, that's what the game's been missing. Okay, sorry. I'll get off the soapbox now. Okay, let's step back a little bit. Usher performing at the Super Bowl. Like, obviously, I know Super Bowl performances are not inherently interesting all the time. They're often somewhat rote, or they're like over theatrical and perhaps underfed musically. But the symbolism of Usher being chosen to perform at the Super Bowl, Danielle, what do you make of that?
I'm really not sure. I know that it has to do with Live Nation and Jay-Z. It's coming at a time where, you know, Usher has had a resurgence in just our kind of public awareness because of a number of career moves, the residency, the Tiny Desk, all these things that have just like brought him back to the top of mind and reminded us of how just underrated he really is. So for me, there's this sense that it's a little bit overdue. I think it's going to be a great show. Usher always delivers like a spectacle and it's going to work hard. I know that he's probably not sleeping at all. You know, I noticed he wasn't sleeping during the period that I interviewed him over around 2 months. I'm sure he's sleeping even less. And he's very regimented and disciplined in his diet and you know, rehearsal schedule. But I feel a little bit of ambivalence because of that. I feel like there was a time, you know, and he's graced the stage before. He made an appearance when the Black Eyed Peas were the headlining acts, right? And got to sing OMG. And I think he parachuted in with Will I Am, and that was wonderful. But there was a time when he was probably the most important pop star in the world, and he wasn't on that stage at that time.
I mean, this says a tremendous amount of things. Obviously, it says things about race in America. It says things about how the NFL's relationship to Black culture obviously was meager for a very, very long time. What's happened with Jay-Z and Roc Nation as they've taken over the Super Bowl halftime show, or taking over the booking, I should say, of the halftime show, has been a radical change. But I think it's important to underscore, again, if we're going back to Confessions era Usher, 8701, but really Confessions era Usher, that album sold 18 million copies. Now, a lot of our, look, if you are a listener who's closer to my age, you'll remember that. You lived through it. If you're a little bit younger, these are Taylor Swift numbers. You know what I mean? Like, this is huge. You know, it's a diamond-selling record. There's not that many R&B albums that are diamond-selling, I think, just in history. In 2004, there was no more famous musician in America than Usher. And I agree, that would have been an incredible time to put him on a platform like this.
I am around about the same age. I'm just like a couple of years younger than Usher. I lived through that period. Every song, even deep cuts, were ubiquitous. The first week, I think it had 1.1 million sales. Like, so going, you know, platinum in 1 week.
But again, the way that these other systems were set up, they were not set up in a way that could acknowledge it or had space for it at that time. So we have to wait for Usher to kind of become, dare I say, I mean, you know, this is not an old man, but like, dare I say, something of an elder in order to get access to this stage. You know, it's unfortunate it took this long. I agree. One thing, Daniel, that you mentioned that I kind of want to dig in on a little bit, you were talking about Usher essentially as a technician. And I think of Usher as certainly like a very physically precise performer and also like a careful singer who has a lot of technical ability, but is not going to over-index on technique. He's using it in a way that still somehow feels approachable and casual, and you can find yourself in it. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Usher's technique, both vocal and physical.
I think that precise and perfection and intricate are words that I would use, having watched him for like a long night in the studio and in multiple rehearsals. He's what people consider Beyonce level perfection, and that he's running the same numbers that he has committed to memory and performed thousands of times at this point, you know, running them over and over again, even at this late stage. So I saw that before the next leg of the residency opened up. You know, I know he keeps a very balanced schedule as far as vocal training. He has a lesson every day, and it's private. I was not allowed to watch that, even though it was like sort of on the table, like I could have possibly, but it's, you know, super intimate with him and his vocal instructor. And he just got a new vocal instructor for years. He had the same one, it's Mama Jan, that, you know, has sung his praises many, many times and has called him, you know, one of the best, most gifted and hardest working singers she's ever worked with. I think that part of why we may view Usher as a stellar showman and performer, most more so than like a vocalist or somebody like Otis Redding, who we think of first and foremost for his vocals. I think it's a matter of what songs have become hits. Musically, we've just been privy to a narrower range of his actual abilities.
In the sort of popular songs, you're saying?
In the actual popular songs that have been released and then become hits. So, yeah, it seems like he's pretty good. But I think there are deeper cuts where you can hear a little bit more stretching and strain and keening and stretching of his, like, abilities and a little bit more experimentation. And I definitely saw them in those in-between moments, once again, in rehearsals, just when he's with his band riffing or preparing for the actual rehearsal. And it's something that I spoke to Faith Evans about, and this didn't make it in my story. No quotes from her made it in the story. And Faith Evans was a signed artist on Bad Boy in the early 90s and was a songwriter and pretty much a producer at the time that Usher was recording and working on his first album. So the legend goes he was signed on the spot by L.A. Reid when he was about 14 years old, and then went to work on his first album with Diddy, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy at the time, in New York, and was recording and working on the album and also working on his Cool and Swagger and all these things. But Faith was a person who would go pick him up every single day after he finished tutoring, take him to the studio, and they worked together on songs, just alone, pretty much the two of them and the engineer. And that's really when he developed and started to, you know, say, can I say this, run this melodic line, you know, or say this lyric, you know, just in a very like cautious and tentative way. And he's a fully functioning independent artist in the studio. He was alone pretty much with the engineer when I was there. I saw him talk about what pockets in which to drop certain drum patterns. So I was really keen on including a scene with him in the studio, first of all, because he was there so long and I was like, I can't believe this is so long. I'm exhausted. And it seemed he got more energy like the closer I got to 4 a.m. I mean, there's that. But, you know, also I hadn't seen a lot written, if anything at all, about just how meticulous and just hard driving he is about keeping his voice in shape and also using it and also the sound of it.
Before we leave this subject, do you have a particular Usher vocal performance, not a big hit, but like something, a song that really shows off that level of technique that stands out to you? Because I think it'd be great for people to hear that.
Yeah, so there's one that's pretty experimental. I've been listening to a good amount recently. It's actually on his last studio album, Hard to Love. It is Missing You. It's one of those early tracks on the album, very underheralded, not a single at all. The phrasing, the quality of his voice is very like jazz-like, like Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, I Can't Help It era kind of phrasing. The song is built on a sample of a cut by Steely Dan. So it's highly musical. There's tempo changes, you know, and it's like in this mid-tempo. And I think, you know, Usher is a rhythm, an artist of rhythm. He's obviously rhythm and blues is like what he considers like his core toolkit. So it's not a ballad. I think that ballads are wonderful. I would say like Superstar is probably one of my favorite Usher ballads, along with Bedtime. But just that mid-tempo where you can get access to his rhythmic acumen, but also hear the range of his voice. And just kind of like the, you know, the sensuality and swagger that he brings, and also like that mix of the sensuality and swagger with the tenderness. And I think that tension is just like his sweet spot, like mixing those two things.
The questions around retirement have gotten tiring. Instead of, have you saved up enough? Shouldn't they be asking, what is it that you love to do? You're not slowing down, so your retirement plan should be more of an action plan, a hiking plan, a golf plan. Lincoln Financial has the products to help protect and grow your financial future. Make your pastimes last a lifetime at LincolnFinancial.com/action plan. Lincoln Financial Group, marketing name for Lincoln National Corporation and its insurance companies and broker-dealer affiliate, Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., 2024, Lincoln National Corporation.
It's interesting what you say kind of about the technical standpoint of Usher, because I just got the sense that he's a real student of music history. Like when I would bring up Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack, Where Is the Love, or Michael Jackson, She's Out of Your Life, like he would instantly beam up and talk about chord changes, talk about how the kind of vulnerability in those vocals inspired him. I think with Usher, the way I kind of see him as a vocalist is he's almost caught between projecting ultimate strength and sounded like he's about to break down in tears. I think that that's a kind of really fascinating way of approaching singing. I think he's very conversational as well with his kind of flow, very colloquial. It's almost like you're sitting in on a dialogue between Angel on your left shoulder telling you to go home and the devil on the right saying give in to temptation, right? So it's very kind of three-dimensional, just the way that he kind of puts the words together. And I think, you know, what I really loved is his later work with Zaytoven when he started to sing over on the A album, where he was singing over beats that you might expect Gunna or the Migos to kind of hop over. But I think the fact that he was able to do that, you know, on a track like You Decide, where it's like, it's got the kind of Future Mask Off-esque distorted flute, like ringing off, but he still belongs there. And I think Usher showed at that point that actually his conversational flow, that duality about being vulnerable, projecting strength, there's a direct thread to that, to a lot of modern trap music. I don't feel like that always kind of gets called out enough. You know, when I hear a song like My Collection from Future, even though if you look at the lyrics of that track, it's misogynist, it's reckless, it's a messed up song, yet Future sings it with this kind of depressed, somber texture that almost gives this impression that even though, you know, he's behind that red velvet rope, he's got all this jewelry on, he's in a luxury nightclub, he's having an existential crisis while being there. And I feel like Usher was almost kind of like the prototype for that, you know, that duality. And you know, his impact on hip-hop is so big, and it's like, again, people don't point that out enough. I think, you know, the fact that he was on the stage with Biggie and Tupac when they were Howard Homecoming, you know, performing Party and Bullshit, like in the, you know, Notorious movie where they all take the t-shirts off, and they, you know, there's that whole kind of sequence where it looks like a riot's about to break out and they get into the track. Well, Usher was there, and I think, you know, that kind of link to hip-hop, I think it's very important that the Super Bowl performance kind of completes that, makes it feel full circle. I think that will probably come with kind of Ludacris and Lil Jon probably jumping on the stage. But I think that that's kind of very, very important. And this is just on an unconnected level, but I got the sense from Usher that the Super Bowl performance, and I completely agree with your points about it should have happened when Confessions dropped. Like, the fact it didn't show the kind of elitist agenda against R&B at the time. But I feel like the Super Bowl performance, from what he told me, is really a love letter to Atlanta and its strip club culture. It's really about kind of taking a place like Magic City and turning it into a holy space to the masses. Now, I don't know how much he'll get away with the censors compared to the show I saw in Paris, where there's moments where it's like, you know, this could be a Pimp C music video, but in a bit of moments which are graceful and incredible, but there's definitely moments where it's like, you know, this might not get past the Super Bowl censors, but I would love it if it did, because I feel like Usher's real mission here is to kind of elevate people who work at those clubs, show that they're artists, and show the kind of, you know, that going back years and years ago, you know, the speakeasies, the brothels, actually a lot of the times it was the kind of the blues musicians, the experimental jazz musicians who were playing at those kind of venues. They were a kind of a platform for some of the greatest art of the last 200 years. You know, in the same way, Magic City in Atlanta, you ask anyone from Gucci Mane to Killer Mike, you know, where's the kind of church for breaking new sounds, new music? And all of them will say that place. And I feel like, above all, this Super Bowl performance, I think that's what Usher wants to do. He wants to pay tribute to that.
It's interesting that the relationship that Usher has had with hip-hop over 20 years feels to me very on and off. And I say that because one of the things about Usher is I feel like he never fully gave in and said, I'm just going to be a guy who always collaborates with rappers. He does it here and there, but he was very forceful, I think, in holding on to the core Usher proposition, which is, I am this kind of showman. I am this kind of performer. And yes, I may occasionally sort of like reach out or invite people into the space, but I'm never going to be a person who only does those kinds of records. And this is also, of course, happening during a stretch of time where, you know, R&B is having moments of creative flourishing, but is being diminished in the big picture, whether in radio or ultimately streaming, is not as present in those spaces. And also the relationship between R&B and hip hop as genre, with hip hop adopting so many structural forms and gestures and flourishes from R&B and bringing it into hip hop, leaving a lot of traditional R&B singers sometimes wondering, okay, well, what about what we do and how does that fit in? And it's interesting, prepping for today, I hadn't listened to the first Usher album in a really long time. And I went back to that album, and this album, this self-titled, came out in 94. And you think 94, so we're after New Jack Swing, but we're in, you know, Uptown Records getting into early Bad Boy. We're really in this moment, especially with what Puff was doing, of bringing some of this R&B performance and attitude into hip hop and finding common ground. And it's interesting because I think there's a little bit of this on this record, but I was surprised 20 years later to hear how firm Usher is standing his ground of saying, no. I understand. Like, I'm aware of what's happening around me. Like, I'm listening to it. Like, I, you know, there's some keyboards on one song that kind of sound like maybe an SWV record or whatever. Like, I'm listening, but I am standing firm in this kind of technique and in this kind of relationship to R&B. And that was really great to hear. And I, you know, it's an album I haven't revisited a lot, but that's what really jumps out at me when I was listening to it the last couple of days.
I think that album is really soulful, and you have to, you know, like you brought up, this is the end of Puff's tenure with Uptown and early Bad Boy era. These are people who are creating kind of out of just like the substance of other stuff that had come before what we think of as hip hop soul. Usher's very first feature in Vibe magazine was in the Next column, and he's called the Prince of New Jack Swing. You know, so New Jack Swing is like when Usher's debut comes out, is like the end of the New Jack Swing moment and this new Jodeci and Mary J. Blige. And Usher is kind of was heralded as the baby of this kind of new movement that's come in. And when you think of somebody like Mary J. Blige, like she has, I guess, rapperly skills and the ability to tell stories and centralize the rhythm in her music. But we think of her as a very soulful singer and interpreter of emotion at the same time. And I think it's good to think of Usher like that, like a person who has kind of perfected and just been part of innovating how those kind of musical traditions can work together. And, you know, something he told me was that, you know, hip hop comes from R&B in the first place. And like Thomas was saying, just really realizing and being astonished by how much Usher is really like a student of the music. He's very firm about R&B's kind of centrality in the various traditions of Black music and American pop overall. So he's talked about, and I think it's his Vogue profile that recently came out, he talked about wanting to showcase and put R&B on the main stage. And he meant R&B theatricality and glamour and sensuality and showmanship, but also connection and what it means culturally for Black people in America, but what it's meant for music, the culture of music overall. And, you know, I think his career has also just really been a testament to that.
So we've managed to get 30, 40 minutes into the show, but we haven't really talked about hits. And one thing that we can say about Usher, we alluded to it earlier, but Usher, for a stretch of time, especially in the early to mid-2000s, consistently put out huge hits. We're talking My Boo, You Remind Me, Yeah, Confessions, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on and on and on. I wonder what, and Thomas, I wonder what you think about this, what, when you listen to those songs kind of as a body, what made those songs Usher specific? What was the thread that linked all those Usher songs together and elevated them even over the work that he was doing in the 90s? What's the common thread in that era of Usher?
I think he'd kind of just reached a pivotal in terms of like vocal control. Like he could hit those highs of a Freddie Jackson or a Minnie Riperton, but also the kind of light, airy lows of a Maxwell, who's one of his peers, or a D'Angelo. Like, it just felt like he was in such kind of control of his voice. And I think, you know, I think a hit from that era that really kind of symbolizes the thread to me that makes all those songs so unforgettable is Burn, in that, you know, you didn't hear a lot of people in that era of kind of hyper-masculinity talking about wanting to break down and cry. You know, Usher even... So he just always felt relatable. It always kind of felt to me like he was more like a life coach than just a singer. I felt like he gave a whole kind of generation of men actually a manual to kind of almost kind of like know how to approach women in a kind of in a way that could lead to you finding the love of your life. I always remember "How Do I Say," you know, that kind of Spanish guitar. Now that isn't the big hit, but you know, when he talks, "I just want to talk to you." Like, I just felt like that lyric, like he almost kind of taught a whole generation of men how to approach women. He raised their confidence. I think at that time in culture, like maybe, you know, maybe with that toxic masculinity, he was always kind of pushing the opposite into the spotlight. But to say all that, Usher also, he broke my heart a little bit too, because all that vulnerability I speak about, that I think you could see on those hits. I think as the 2000s kind of passes on, he starts to sound less relatable. And as the kind of EDM soundscapes get more and more kind of obvious, I feel like he becomes more like the kind of tropey R&B point, especially the singles that kind of Usher used to kind of decry and kind of be the antithesis of. Like, I remember going to university, and I remember around 2008, and you could not hear his collaborations of like David Guetta, and I hear about, you know, Love in This Club, and to me, I associate those songs with kind of Jaeger bombs, which are like a disgusting cheap shot, you know, like they smell of sick, you know, like people from student unions dressed up as like the cast of Shrek for a kind of social night out, like all the men were wearing kind of horrible chinos, like like it just brings me very vividly to that kind of moment when I hear some of the EDM Usher. And I just felt a little bit, as a listener, as somebody who came into Usher as, you know, somebody who, you know, whenever I felt kind of depressed, his music almost lifted my spirit. It was almost suddenly like he was untouchable. He was making music all of a sudden for people who were a bit arrogant. I think on Love 'Em All, in some way, compares his dick to an aeroplane. I feel like Usher wouldn't have done that maybe in the 90s or kind of early 2000s. I felt like he lost some of kind of that empathy a little bit.
You know, we were emailing in advance of the episode, and I think that EDM era is fascinating because not only does it feel thematically like a left turn, and I feel this sometimes even with Usher songs that have come out in the last, I don't know, 3 years or 4 years, where you'll be like, this is not really part of the oeuvre. Like, this is some, like, someone put these lyrics in front of you. There's no way you wrote that. Like, it just doesn't feel part of the overall thing. But it does, I think, it is consistent with something that I think happens with a lot of incredibly famous people, which is you build your fame upon, let's just say, something that's philosophically cogent. You know, in Usher's case, maybe it's the, as you say, the Aristotelian approach to seduction that takes into consideration the seducer and the seduced. Maybe it's that. Then you get really famous. You have many things pulling at you. And then people just want a little taste. They just want like Ode Usher. They don't know if they can't tell the difference between like Ode Usher and actual Usher. And then you end up with songs like the EDM era. Danielle, I wonder, when you think of that era of Usher, how do you view that in relationship to the 2000s era in true R&B Usher? Do you see it as an extension? Do you see it as in opposition? How do you see those things working together or not?
I see them as, you know, part of an imperative of a really gifted Black artist who built his foundation on pretty much a Black audience. And there was a time when music that was foundational to a Black audience was also kind of automatically just like had stormed. There was a moment when, you know, in 2004, for example, when the top 10 songs on the Hot 100 were all from so-called urban artists. And then it started to change. So I see there's an imperative to continue to sell records and to get out, to get the music out to as many people as possible, many ears as possible. So I see like market demands. I also do see a link though to other songs. I mean, yeah, to me is an EDM song. And hip hop is also, you know, has something to do with electronic and dance music. So they're related. They're not completely outside of the tradition, but I do see market forces at play, you know, that we've seen in the trajectories of any number of really big Black pop stars.
Also, I think it's worth saying, for whatever the flaws of the Super Bowl halftime show being not able to acknowledge Usher in his 2000s commercial prime. That's one thing. Then to pick up on what you just said, Danielle, about obviously the pressures placed on Black artists when it comes to audience and market and broad, wide ear, quote unquote, crossover or mainstream, which are not real terms, but that's how the industry thinks, receptiveness. But also, I think I wonder if we arrive at Usher finally performing at the Super Bowl, if there isn't the David Guetta records. Like, on some level, those are the kinds of songs that this performance demands. And I think we've seen in recent Super Bowls, people performing stuff that's maybe not their best work, but it is their biggest tent work, quote unquote. It is their kind of grabbiest and maybe least technically proficient work. And I wonder if maybe even if we don't love those songs in the same way as we love the older stuff, maybe that smooths the path to something like this. How do you think, in terms of what he's going to maybe deliver at the show, how do you think the EDM or this era of Usher will figure into that?
I definitely think he's going to have to perform some of those. And in a similar way to the how the residency is structured, I didn't see the show in Paris, but I saw it in Vegas a few times. And there's like an entire kind of EDM era coda. And he like goes out on the song Without You. And it's pretty ebullient. Although, you know, my section probably full of more day ones, you know, who want to hear like Think of You and other stuff from the 90s, you know, are like, okay, you know, not standing up as much. But that was a huge focus of the Vegas residency. And the person that I was sitting next to, it was actually Hazel E from Love & Hip Hop.
Hey.
Right. And she spoke, we were talking a lot throughout the show. She has a background in like PR for the music industry. So, you know, it was really great to hear her armchair analyses. But she was like, well, he's got to perform these songs to show, you know, because he's in conversations for the Super Bowl.
I'm a massive hypocrite because I was like swaying side to side when he did Love in This Club. Like, I can't lie. So
those to me always felt like Usher songs that were concessions for some part of the world or some part of the music business. That was not the part that I was terribly concerned about. But I think if you listen to them retroactively, if you go back and try to draw the threads from Love in This Club to Yeah and Confession, like, I think they're there, which if anything, I think is a testament to just how effective Usher is as a singer. The fact that Usher remains Usher by and large, regardless of the context. And most of the time, it's his own context, but every now and again, he ends up in an outer context. And you know, with the occasional misstep, more or less stands on business, as it were.
And I guess so often kind of white pop artists are allowed to straddle all those different genres and have these kind of different eras. And when a kind of black artist chooses to experiment or kind of level up, we instantly say, oh, why isn't it like the old music? So I feel like, you know, actually the EDM era is a lot more kind of radical and important than we kind of give it credit for. It definitely kind of created a lane. But I think that just because of my personal memories being so tied to like moments where like I wanted to forget, you know, I was the guy at university who was listening to Wilco on my headphones. That EDM era probably is just tied to those memories to me. But I think as I get older, I appreciate what it symbolized a lot more, definitely.
One of the things we were emailing about, and this is probably a good ending off ramp, is look, we can probably sit here and sketch out the 7 to 10 songs that Usher's going to play in those 12 minutes this coming weekend. But we all have deep cut passion periods. I wonder maybe if each of us just go around the horn and talk about one meaningful deep cut that we'd love to hear, but we are reconciled to the fact that probably we're not going to hear. Danielle, do you want to start?
Oh, gosh, there are a couple for me. First, I just want to kind of go back to what you said about what is it that makes that like period of Usher that we find so memorable. Like, what is it that ties all those songs together sonically and thematically? And I think about these mid-tempos or even up-tempo grooves that just feel really good. Like, they make you feel cool. They make you feel like you want to dance or you want to forget. So I'm thinking about You Don't Have to Call, which is actually about a breakup. But it's about like a joyous ending to it. Like, I'm going to be okay, he said over and over again. Or something like My Way, which is super energetic and like has like a rap in it, but it's still, you know, he's singing his face off on those. Or something like Caught Up. So I think he just can get in this like pocket of a groove, ride it out, take you along with him and make you feel really great. That said, I would say my deep cuts are songs like that didn't become really big hits. So it's going to be Good Kisser for me. So that possibly might be one that he actually performs. He performs it in Vegas. It's a more recent song. I think it's so musical. He has a part in it that there's like tempo changes. He's a part in it where it sounds like it's like taking from a Femi Kuti song, Bang, Bang, Bang. Highly musical, sexual, fun, a little bit naughty, but again, tender, just like that tension once again between naughty and tender. That would be my one.
Let's listen to Good Kisser. I'm staring at your barrel, pull the trigger, cheaty, cheaty, bang, bang. I told her, the devil is a
lie. You know, I'm going to bring up a song from 2015 just because when I listen to it, I don't instantly think this is Usher, but I think it kind of really shows his range. And that's the song Chains with Nas. You know, this was a few years before you had all the kind of yuppies changing their avatars to kind of black stars and acting like that was meaningful action. And Usher was singing lines like, you know, you act like the change, trying to throw me in chains. Don't act like you're saving us. It's still the same. I think that was really kind of a prescient message. I think people don't realize that Usher has always kind of spoke about racial dynamics in America, sometimes in quite a subtle way, but it was great to kind of hear a track where he was kind of outright making a kind of quote-unquote political R&B song. I'm a betrayal, you should be trail too. Shouldn't even count on time, we just shoot.
So my deep cut is actually what comes right after Think of You on the first album, which is a song called Crazy, which is not one of the big songs on this record. If anything, I think Think of You and maybe Can You Get With It, those are the sort of hits on this record. Crazy comes after those. And in reading both of your pieces, I was thinking a lot about Usher's relationship to R&B history. And I think historically we see Usher as a very modern performer who is technically gifted and has an eye and an ear for the contemporary and even, dare I say, the future in production choices, especially when we're getting into the early 2000s era. What I hear on this first album, and Crazy really jumped out in me, is I hear someone really holding both things at the same time, holding how do I be an artist who is making quote unquote contemporary music that's going to resonate with young people or contemporary youth focused audience? And also, how do I let these people know I can sing and I'm in conversation and maybe even on a level with the people from the 80s and the 70s who came before me? And this song, of all the songs of this album, felt like the song that holds those ideas at the same time. So that would be my deep cut. We'll play it at the end. Danielle Thomas, hell of a conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This was so fun.
No, I really appreciate it. You guys are both legends, so it's great to be chopping up with you always.
This is hopefully the first of many times that we can do a version of this. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast, youtube.com/podcast. That's where Podcast Deluxe is with me and Joe on the chairs. We'll be off this week. No, we'll be off this week, but we'll be back after this week. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord or /podcast Facebook. Email me, podcast@nytimes.com, if you want to talk your Usher deep cuts. The stickers and the remaining t-shirts are at itsthepodcast.myshopify.com. We will be back next week. This is Usher Crazy. You all my mind.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.